Now that we're firmly into the month of July, we're past the halfway point of 2009, and that has members of NPR's music team thinking about how this year stacks up musically in its midlife. I'm joined by All Songs Considered host Bob Boylan. And Bob, you are conducting a poll of the best music of 2009.
We're asking people to give us their favorite three songs of the year, favorite three records of the year. We'll take all of those, total them up, and then we're going to make a poll out of it. And that poll, people will vote on, and in very soon, toward the middle of July, you'll be able to discover what people's favorite records and favorite songs are.
And you have brought in with you today your three favorite songs of the year, with some qualifications. Let's listen to your first song.
Set the sails, I feel the winds are stirring. Towards the bright horizon.
I get chills at the moment I hear this guy's voice.
It's an amazing voice. Who is this?
This is Ben Knox Miller. The group is called The Low Anthem. It's their second record. They put it out as a very under-the-radar album back in 2008. And some folks at Nonsense Records heard it, reordered the song listing, put it out. And the record's called Oh My God, Charlie Darwin. This is a song about Charles Darwin. And the record has these underpinnings of history of Charles Darwin, all set in this fairly folky and at times hymnal quality song structure.
So this is the song Charlie Darwin by The Low Anthem. Your second pick for favorite song of the year so far?
Let's do something really different. Let's get to a much poppier number. There's a group called Fant Farlow, and Fant Farlow are a British group led by a Swedish singer. They also took a historical figure, a fellow named Harold T. Wilkins. Harold T. Wilkins was a journalist who sort of got caught up in his love, or fascination maybe is a better way to put it, for flying saucers. And this song's called Harold T. Wilkins, or How to Wait for a Very Long Time.
We've got Harold T. Wilkins, Charles Darwin, two biographical songs. What's your third pick?
The next one is sort of a cinematic bit of music. It's a fellow named Patrick Watson. His band he calls The Wooden Arms. This song is called Beijing, and it's a song that he wrote after being there. There's pots and pans and all sorts of odd percussion. If you listen really, really carefully, you'll hear, being inspired by bicycles all over Beijing, you'll hear the turning of a chain on a bicycle and the spokes of the bicycle. And you've got to listen really carefully.
Oh, it's really subtle.
But that's the beauty of this music, is the subtlety. Over and over again, you can hear these songs and new things pop out, and that's why I like Patrick Watson a lot.
So the song Beijing by Patrick Watson, your third pick for Song of the Year. Bob, tell me more about this poll that you're conducting with your fans.
Send us your nominations, favorite three songs. Go to the All Songs Considered site, favorite three songs of the year, favorite three records of the year, and then we'll tally all the best ones. We'll put them in a poll, and then you'll be able to vote for them at npr.org/allsongs.
And we'll bring you those results later on in the summer on All Things Considered. All Songs Considered host Bob Boylan, thanks so much.
Thanks, pleasure.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. During his long career, Michael Jackson shattered some major racial barriers in the entertainment world. The pop idol also had a complicated relationship with African Americans. Now, as his fans prepare to say goodbye, much of Black America is ready to reassert its claim on Michael, as NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
Every year, people come from all over the city to attend the jazz festival in Leimert Park, the cultural heart of Black Los Angeles. There's always African drums and barbecue galore. Last year, there were a lot of Obama t-shirts. This year, it's Michael Jackson. Myra Jackson, no relation, is wearing one.
We love Michael. We love him, and it's very hard for us to let go. And like he said, it's very hard to say goodbye. Never, never say goodbye.
Then I asked Myra a question that has come up often.
A lot of people said he's getting paler, he's trying to turn away from the Black community. Did you believe that?
No, I did not. Not at all.
Marvin Hurrell thought this transracial look was part of Jackson's appeal.
He was just a natural artist sharing his soul. His soul didn't have no color. He was colorblind.
But Jackson's increasingly pale visage, his two white wives, and his legal troubles in the latter part of his career did not go down well with some Black fans. Chad Robison, manning the pit at Dre's Barbecue, says he understood why Jackson might have pulled away from the Black community.
I think he had a little bit of a reason to, because a lot of Black people started talking about him once he got into all the child molestations and how he started changing his face and stuff like that. So I'm not mad at him if that's how people feel. I don't feel that way, but, you know.
Jackson's death has revived the conversation about his life's ups and downs. At the BET Awards, a few days after Jackson died, host Jamie Foxx wanted the world beyond the Black community to understand that Michael Jackson was family, however he looked.
We want to celebrate this Black man. He belongs to us, and we shared him with everybody else.
Even many Blacks who weren't Jackson fans were outraged at the rampant speculation the media engaged in about the singer's personal life and past legal troubles. In Los Angeles, visiting pastor Al Sharpton publicly chastised the media at Sunday's service at First AME Church.
When you have had other entertainers that had questions in their life, you did not degrade and denigrate them before their funeral like you've done Michael Jackson.
The media should be focusing on Jackson's contributions, not his idiosyncrasies, Sharpton thundered.
We know that Michael fought and made a way and opened doors for us, and Michael wasn't no freak. He was a genius.
Some people thought Jackson was both. Greg Braxton is an entertainment writer for the Los Angeles Times who has covered Jackson extensively. Braxton says Jackson's kaleidoscope of hues, from brown to ghostly pale, both intrigued and puzzled the public.
But obviously, color did play a part in Michael Jackson's persona, and it remains one of the most fascinating paradoxes of his whole legacy.
In the aftermath of Jackson's death, many Black fans are concentrating on celebrating the man and his achievements. They're taking a page from Jackson's own songbook.
I'm not gonna spend my life being a color fan.
Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
And you can watch videos of Black comedians on Michael Jackson over the years at nprmusic.org.
Finally this hour, music to enhance a summer road trip. Heat and traffic and constant queries of "Are we there yet?" can make traveling tedious. Our critic Tom Moon suggests this soundtrack to make the trip go faster.
As soon as the first road trip of the summer is on the calendar, I begin searching for music that can help make the ride from point A to point B a pleasurable experience. I'm a creature of habit, so typically I gravitate toward the old, faithful, tried-and-true driving companions, like the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers. For me, this is the essence of driving music. It just pulls you along with sheer locomotive force. You can chew up lots of miles with this blasting. But according to my family, I've relied on the almonds a few too many times. So before hitting the road this year, I sought out only new stuff.
I don't know. I've been around. Them Georgia women shake on down.
That's from the self-titled debut of Hill Country Review, a spin-off from the North Mississippi All-Stars. These guys come from the blues, but they specialize in a sweaty, supercharged update that owes as much to the almonds as Muddy Waters. The whole album has this kind of energy.
I'm going down. Told you lie. Sleeping with me. Sweet like mine. Sweet like mine. Sweet like mine. Sweet like mine. Oh, sweet like mine, yeah!
In addition to intense rhythm, sometimes what I need in the car is music that on some level engages my brain. The latest from Green Day, 21st Century Breakdown, does that. It's a full-blown rock opera about what it means to hold on to ideals when prospects are bleak. The Green Day mix, punk attitude, classic rock hooks, and comic book philosophy, is downright galvanizing. Of course, you also need variety on the road, some intense music to keep you alert during the day, and music that can chill you out and renew your spirit in the evening when you still have hours more to go. The violinist and singer Sarah Watkins of Nickel Creek has a wonderfully desolate late-night tune on her first solo album. It's called Bygones.
As faint as a phantom, but I can't pull you under, bound to you in bygones. You took it to the limit and glimpsed all that you'd been missing. Found yourself a secret.
Some music makes a road trip better, and sometimes the trip itself enhances the music. That's the case with Wilco's new album. The band's seventh studio effort has lighthearted melodies and Morse code guitar blasts that seem to blossom when you're moving.
Come on, children, you're acting like children. Every generation thinks it's the end of the world.
That tune has lots going for it, including a grabby refrain that's tailor-made for singing along.
It's a dream down a well. It's a long, heavy hell. I don't care anymore. I don't care.
To me, that right there sounds like summer on the open road.
Our critic Tom Moon is the author of 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die. And you can find all his suggestions for road trip music at nprmusic.org.
Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Neil Carruth. The technical director is Bill Deputy. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
Our planning editors are Susan Feeney and Jerry Holmes. The staff includes Franklin Cater, Andrea Hsu, Rob Ballinger, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Chelsea Jones, Viet Le, and Rhonda Ray. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's a secret I can't tell. As a witch down a well, I don't care.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. This year, Merge Records, a small independent label based in North Carolina, is celebrating its 20th anniversary. And at a time when the record industry as a whole is struggling, Merge really is celebrating. What started as a tiny outlet for local bands has grown into one of the most respected and successful independent labels in the music business. Its roster includes M. Ward, Arcade Fire, and Spoon, and the label's releases have even begun to crack Billboard's top 10. Jacob Gans tells us about the label's simple formula for success.
This is the sound of The Garage, North Carolina, 1989. The band is Superchunk. In the spring of 89, two of its members, Mac McCon and Laura Balance, were looking for a way to release 7-inch singles of their band and other local groups.
We figured, you know, why not put these singles out so at least there's some record of these bands that we really like.
And some chance that someone outside of Raleigh and Chapel Hill would get to hear them, and something they could take on tour with them.
So they launched Merge. Today, starting a small label can be as simple as firing up the laptop, pressing record, burning CDs, and then posting samples on MySpace. But 20 years ago, the process was a little more mysterious.
For me, growing up and looking at my dad's record collection, I didn't know how stuff got from being music that was played by the Rolling Stones somewhere to being on a record, you know what I mean, to being in my dad's living room.
Getting music into living rooms can still be kind of complicated, especially when you're dealing with physical CDs. Once you've actually made them, you still have to get them into stores, mostly small independent ones. Then comes publicity and radio play and touring to let fans know the records are out there. What continues to set Merge apart from other labels doing this is that it hasn't built its rep on a single band or sound. Alex Ross writes about classical music for the New Yorker magazine.
It's kind of like a cross-section of the entirety of pop music, or it is indie music, of the last 20 years.
The names include Lamb Chop.
To whom can I speak today? The brothers, they are evil. And the old friends of today, they have become unlovable.
Magnetic Fields.
I don't want to get old. I could take a sleeping pill and sleep back well, and I'll have to go through what I go through.
Neutral Milk Hotel.
When you were young, you were the king of gathered flowers, and how you built a tower tumbling through the trees in holy rattlesnakes that fell all around your feet.
Arcade Fire. Even if the music doesn't all sound alike, there is a unifying sensibility, says Rich McLaughlin. McLaughlin runs The Alternate Side, an indie music show on WFUV-FM, and programs one of the station's HD channels. He says FUV gets over 100 CDs a day, all vying for attention.
There are very few labels, I think, that you can trust their entire roster of artists. So I think when you see Merge Records envelope coming in, it's something that you set aside because you have a pretty good idea that you can trust the label and trust their output.
Every one of those Merge bands is handpicked by Laura Balance and Mac McCon, who still run the label out of North Carolina without any investment from a major. They say that the exposure that comes with a release by Arcade Fire brings new listeners within their reach. But working on a small scale doesn't mean that each new record isn't a gamble.
Oh, they're all gambles. Every single one.
It's just that we're gambling with very small amounts of money.
Yeah.
Even so, McCon and Balance have to be tough.
It doesn't always make bands happy to be told, we're expecting your record will sell maybe 2,000, and that's how we're going to market it. But I guess, you know, running a successful business sometimes involves saying things that aren't always nice for people's feelings.
They're not going to spend tons of money on the things that aren't really necessary. They're very frugal.
Britt Daniel is the singer for the band Spoon, which signed with Merge in 2001 and has stayed with the label ever since. Spoon is now one of Merge's biggest successes, but at the time the musicians were signed, they looked like damaged goods. They had just been dumped by Elektra Records and were anything but a sure bet.
There was a small amount of investment on their part, and it wasn't necessary that we sold, 100,000 records in order for them to turn a profit. So I guess sort of long term, it was just about the ability to just put out records at our own pace, the kind of records that we wanted to make, and do exactly what we wanted to do.
Anything you want. Come on back, 'cause it's all still here.
A big part of the label's anniversary celebration this year is a 14-CD, mail-order-only box set. Mac McCon admits it's ridiculous, but insists that it's exactly the kind of package, extravagant, mysterious, and lovingly curated, that he dreamed about when he and Laura Balance started Merge 20 years ago.
I think that we've always run the label as music fans, And I think that our customer base is music fans. We started a label and we run a label counting on there being people like us.
For two decades, at least, they've been right. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Gans.
Later this month, Merge is throwing itself a birthday party right down the road from where the label pressed its first 7-inch records. 5 nights of live shows, 25 bands celebrating 20 years. You can hear some of their music at npr.org.